My name is Kate Laurie, and I'm introducing a topic called about Chronicle, in particular, use of heat. I'm going to start through with the presentation I have already, just so that everyone's familiar at least with what the library's about and what its purpose is. And I was hoping then to delve into a bit of a discussion about things we learned about coding for off-heat memory. Okay, so we have two projects, which this slide's a little bit old. We've decided to keep it simple and rename them Chronicle Q and Chronicle Map. The Q is an unbounded Q, could also be considered a journal. It's designed to be penned only, although it can be used for random access. And it's also useful for inter-process communication, recording everything that goes in and out of the system. We have another library called Huge Collections, but in reality it's not all collections, it's only really map, and we've renamed that Chronicle Map. And that's designed to have large maps of data, and it's also a means of allocating memory of heat. And two of the key principles is that it's designed for millions of operations per second and sub-microsecond latency for trivial cases, and 2 to 3 microseconds for non-trivial cases. So the main difference with high frequency compared to, say, maybe some of the web-based applications is that for web-based application, if it's too fast for a human to see, it's usually fast enough. Whereas in HFT, you've got a different problem space because just being too fast to see, it's possibly at least one, if not two, orders of magnitude too slow. So you want to be going down to a much lower level, which means obviously your system has to monitor itself, because no human can see whether it's running fast enough or not. And you also need a system that can record a lot of very low level timing information, so that you can get visibility as to what it's doing. Another thing that's different about HFT, which is that when people talk about unsafe, they say, well, if unsafe doesn't work, we have a fallback, right? And that's a very common and a very sensible behavior. In HFT, there's no such thing as a fallback. The reason why you don't want a fallback is that trading slowly can lose you money, right? Everything's running correctly, but on every trade, on balance, you're losing money. So it is actually better to not trade if you're too slow. You would rather the thing fail. Because if it fails, you either make or lose money. But if it runs successfully but incorrectly, you lose money. You can lose money very fast. You can lose money faster than you make money, which is not surprising. Losing money at a rate of, say, 10,000 a minute is not that hard to do if you've got a bug in your system. Even if you've got the normal checks and balances, right? So this is a system that's already designed to have lots of checks and balances. Even then, you can run into those sort of scenarios. Knightsbridge, or I can't remember the name. There was an HFT this year that managed to lose hundreds of millions before they managed to switch off the system. So yeah, running incorrectly is a bad thing. So that means that worrying about fallbacks is less of a priority. Obviously, when it comes to things like ease of use, we want to consider that, but that's where we're coming from. It's very much around event-driven processing. Now, more recently, there's a broader category, which is reactive programming. That is actually broader than just event-driven. We focus very much on event-driven, and that's because you want to be able to respond to every event as quickly as possible. The value of the information that you're given decreases rapidly. So, for example, if you take a millisecond to respond to a piece of information, its value is probably decreased by tenfold. If you can respond to it in 100 microseconds, the value to you is much higher. Obviously, doing long ad hoc queries is not a priority in this kind of problem space. So, what's a simple example? simple example is that we have market data coming in, but you also have trading information coming in as well. These are often separate systems. You have market data one end, order management the other. And you have in your key part of your system, you've got data premiums, you've got market data parsing, strategies that process this market data information and make decisions to what they want to do. And then the order manager that handles the lifecycle of the orders. And at each of these stages, you want to have a complete record of everything the system does. So you're looking, when you're trying to debug this system, you're often looking for very rare events or very expensive events. A lot of it's about reducing the risk of your system. You want a system that's deterministic. You want a system that every day will do the same thing, given exactly the same inputs. There's no variation in your system. This is an interesting implication for failover, because if you have a completely deterministic system and it has an error, then if you fail over, it should run over the same data and produce the same error every time you do that. So a failover tends to happen with random, non-repeatable errors, and you actually want to minimize those. Another impact of HFT is that, say your system fails and you've got a failover site. Failover site usually is slower, has longer network connections. So you don't necessarily want to fail over if it means that you would continue trading above better ones. So everything's focused around the critical path. You have a critical path in your system. You want that critical path to be as short and as deterministic as possible. So the effect of this is that you push all of the data off the critical path. Any work that doesn't need to be on the critical path, constantly squeezing it out. And so you shorten your critical path as much as possible. So what does Chronicle do? It's designed to be just very fast journal, very fast inter-process communication. That means that a lot of features that you would expect in most products, it doesn't have, because they will slow you down. And there's usually ways of programming around these lack of features, and so it depends on whether, obviously there's a particular tool that's suitable for certain tasks. And so where does it come from? It's for applications originally that were designed to be sub 100 microseconds end-to-end. So that's external to your network. So the entire, from the time the packet hits your network to the time you respond to that packet, is very consistently below 100 microseconds, at least 90%. And more recently, I've seen cases where it's more like 99% of the time. And this is in Java. Obviously, if you're talking about C and FPGAs, they're talking, say, 10 microseconds or less. But that's not practical in Java. So we started with the low latency. More recently, we've looked at more high throughput systems. So again, we're looking at hundreds of thousands of events per second in real systems, although, again, if you do sort of synthetic benchmarks, we're looking in the millions. So it's one of the key, some of the key principles of it is that we keep things GC-free, lockless, or at least as lockless as possible. We make use of shared memory to share between the processes. We support both text and binary, although in reality, if we go down to this level, most people stick to binary. We support replication over TCP, and more recently, we have a UDP replication. And we support thread affinity, and in the sense that we support busy weighting models. Okay, so this is something that you could do before with Chronicle. We've now got better support for that in Chronicle Logger, so that you can use it as a logging framework. Part of the reason we shifted to doing this is that it has the least impact on an application. You can take one line of logging, we can change that to use, so Chronicle to do the logging of that one line. It has no impact on the rest of your application, so it's very light touch. And this is in fact how a lot people start using Chronicle. So it doesn't mean you have to redesign your system at all. However, to use it the way it was originally intended usually implies some sort of redesign so that you can feed both your inputs and outputs through a chronicle. This is more of a design effort, but you often find that in the process of doing this, they reduce, particularly, say, like 90 percentile or 99 percentile latencies dramatically. But also, you get a deterministic system out of it, is generally the aim, so that you've got a system that will reproducibly show the same bugs or not show the same bugs from production to test and vice versa. You can even take it to the extreme where, as production is running, you replicate all the inputs to test and run up your next generation system on new code, but using live production data as it happens, and then you can see how the two systems behave in real time. The difference being, say, 0.1 milliseconds apart, which is incredibly tight. Another thing that's key if you're looking at performance is you want microsecond accurate timestamps, or actually probably 10 microseconds is generally enough because you're looking out for outliers. And so we need systems that can log a lot of information about every event and log every event. So you're going to be writing lots of information out, so you need to do that as quickly as possible so that it doesn't slow down your application. And it can be done in production without impacting your software. So here's a low-level example of writing to Chronicle. This is using our older library, which is possibly is the simplest, but like I said, it doesn't have some of the features you might want to have. We have a newer version called Vanilla Chronicle, which is a bit slower. It still does the 3 million a second. But it has things like file rolling and supports replication, rolling of files from one day to the next or hourly. So as you can see, it's pretty low level. You start an entry, you write the entry, and then when you finish it, it commits and it adds it to the index. If you don't call finish, then that entry is discarded. So if it crashes before finish is called, then that entry is truncated. If you finish completes, it's not truncated. And the assumption here is that while the application might crash, the OS does not. If the OS crashes, then to some degree all bets are off as to what's going to happen. And this is where a lot of banks will use TCP replication on the assumption that they won't have both machines crash at the same time. Reading this back in, and as you can see, there's a busy waiting loop there in the middle. And once it's got an entry, you can busy wait, of course, on any number of sources. But once you've got an entry, you pick it up and you process it. Now, why do we invest so much in assuming busy waiting is okay? That's because we have a highly tuned system. Small number of critical threads, possibly only one, number of clients with one critical thread. Everything goes through it, and that critical thread is locked on an isolated CPU. It never gets interrupted, it never gives up a CPU, the cache never powers down, it's always warm, so then it will always respond to every event as if it were as close to hot as possible. So that way you get the minimum disturbance of your latencies. And you might say, well, what if we used more threads? Why not use more threads? Well, in most of these cases, they started with a system that used more threads. And by switching from more threads to one thread, they improved both the performance and the consistency. And that's because they had so many threads, it was actually creating an enormous overhead. Now, having cut down to one thread, and now considering going to two threads or three threads. But they haven't yet done that. But they have that capability. One client I had, they started with a system with what this critical thread was doing, they were using 5,600 threads. So they started with a system of 5,600 threads. They had a particular target workload for quite a long period of time. They couldn't even measure what the target workload latencies were. We cut it down with threads. We got it to the point where they could measure it. By the time we got it down to actually using one thread, it was the 99th percentile, was a tenth, nearly a 20th of what their first measurement was. That was only after reworking it. So you shouldn't go with the assumption that just because you're using less threads, that you necessarily get less performance. Certainly when you're considering latency. When you're considering throughput, then more threads can help. But if you're looking at trying to get reliable latencies, more threads are generally going to help. Okay, so that's not forming properly, but... Okay, so this is just what I was talking about with Vanilla Chronicles, the newer one, which has got the firewall, and I'm writing text to that instead of binary. But get the idea, it's just append. Okay, so here's an example from one of our clients, I think. They take a packet in on server A. Server A replicates to server B. Server B actually does the processing, so A doesn't have to wait. Processing doesn't have to wait for the packet to come back to A. So the standard model is often A replicates to B, B replicates, tells A that it got that replication, then B can continue. But of course, you've got two half round trips that you're paying. So as the latency of your network, because of course you want redundancy, you want two data centers, often as far apart as you can, but no further than you can afford in terms of latency. So you've got two machines now. So you want to only really pay for half the round trip if you can, and that's one way of doing it. So A replicates to B, B actually does the processing, it takes its result, replicates it back to A, so now we've got a record of both all the inputs and outputs, and then A continues. It's actually sends the reply back to the thing that triggered the event in the first place, assuming that's your workflow. The workflow we had before, it doesn't actually need to go back to A, it could go on to C, which actually sends it off to. In this case, the reason why A and B get a copy of everything is that either A or B can fail, and you will have either a complete or almost complete record. There is cases where if B fails, it doesn't know whether A sent the message or not. But there is actually a means of determining that as well.
Yeah, sorry, maybe a trivial question. I just missed what it is that we are replicating in terms of data.
This is an inbound event. So say, for example, a client sends a new order signal, they want to create a new order. That would come to A sends it to B. B actually does the processing of that order, sends back an execution of the order, and it goes back to A. A replies back to the original client.
Okay. But even in this case, we could still have inconsistency. In that case, if you still have inconsistency, then what is it that you do? Just discard that data?
It's only, all that matters is what the client sees. Right? So if say, for example, B processed the event, and A didn't get the event, it doesn't matter that B processed the event. Because from the end user's point of view, there's no difference. A then reprocesses the event and then sends back the reply B should have sent. So if there's a failure but it's completely transparent to the client, it doesn't actually matter. It's the assumption.
Yeah, what it means is it isn't allowed to mutate external data, because in this case you couldn't replay it.
You couldn't replay it. The external data has to be fed off the output of A. So it's considered then a downstream system.
But it could happen that the order is processed twice by A and B just because of the result.
Yes. But as long as it's not sent, that the client doesn't know that it had to do twice as much work on a failure, then the client doesn't need to know that. It doesn't want to. Because say B fails and A has to reprocess all the events that B had already processed, but A didn't get the results of, then, okay, so it's basically part of the cost. to occur in the replane. But because it's a deterministic system, A should redo everything B that it missed from B exactly the way B would have done.
So initially A doesn't process the event unless B fails.
That's correct. And it will only have to process the ones that it doesn't have the results for.
So and the reason for that, why don't you trigger the process of A?
You could make A and B do the same processing and then check that the results are the same. But the problem is that you have to, A has to wait for B to send the result. Otherwise, you've got the possibility that A has sent a reply to the client based on the results it computed, but then A fails. B then doesn't know what A has sent. If A fails in this scenario, B always knows what B knows that A hasn't sent anything B hasn't processed. Look at B, in this loop, B has to process it before A can send it.
So the contact point for a client is server A?
Yes, in this.
And that's why you are not doing processing on server A?
They're all persisting. In fact, every one of these hops has four persistences of this message. So if you shut down A and B, either one of them, after restarting the data again, could continue on.
So I'm a little slow. So how does this slide actually relate to Chronicle?
Okay.
Like your previous slides had examples of reading and writing.
Yes.
From Chronicle. How does this match with that?
Okay, so in this case, server A gets an event off a socket, or a message off a socket, or a request, and that's written into a Chronicle. Right? Chronicle then replicates it to B, so you have a reader on B that's reading this Chronicle that's been replicated, and then picks it up and processes it. It's the result of that processing that's written to a Chronicle on B, which is replicated by Chronicle back to A. Then you have a reader on the return path on A, which is what replies back to the client.
Okay, so you've got a pair of Chronicles, and they've been configured to replicate in A2B.
Yes. Yes, yes, it uses DCP replication. Correct.
How long A waits for result from B?
Forever. It doesn't time out.
And if B doesn't returns the result, A doesn't reply to the client.
Correct, yes. So you need to have another detection mechanism to determine that B has failed or not. But certainly you might say if it hasn't responded for a certain number of milliseconds, then there's a problem.
There's a reprocessor between the chronicles, so you can determine if another chronicle will write the result or even the result. You can say 100 milliseconds. There is no response for 100 milliseconds and the other one is probably dead.
Yes.
What if it takes 5 seconds to process the request and then can you have
these are requests that have a requirement that they should complete within, say, 100 microseconds almost all the time.
So
that's including all of these hops and all this persistence. So if you've got a 5 second delay for any reason, you've got a problem in your system.
So the client is responsible for replaying this event?
No, if B fails, A is responsible for replaying the event and replying to client what B should be sent to.
Okay, so A has a detection mechanism, so we trigger some timer to wait the response from B. And if it doesn't get the response, it just starts processing?
From where it was up to. So B, when it sends a reply, it will say, this is a reply to event N that was in A. So it knows where it's up to, and then when A takes over, it says, right, I was up to this processing this event, and continues on from there.
When B recovers, will A start sending a request, replicate there, or?
Sorry?
Let's say B fails, A starts an event.
Yes.
So, will it ever start sending to B again? Is B considered dead forever? Then you have to remove them.
It probably is. I mean, this is an event that should be happening less than once a year. So if A then fails, then you've got the possibility of restarting A or B. And if that's not acceptable, in reality, this client has a C as well. So A and B are actually on the same data center, and C is in another data center.
And how is the split brain phenomenon protected? What if B fails? Well, A thinks B failed.
Yes.
B thinks A failed, and both start processing events.
Okay, so B thinks A failed. A is no longer listening to B, so what B does no longer matters.
Cool.
But if A is processing, A takes over doing the responding to the client. So, they because it's a deterministic system, they should both do the same result anyway.
But A is an entropy system, right?
Yeah.
It's not A and B in parallel, it's
so
one.
Correct. So A is master, right?
A is master, even though it just sits there and watches B do all the work until it figures it has to take over.
So that I mean,
once
A fails.
The
reason for replication is so that if either machine fails, the other one can take over. So you've got node redundancy.
But since that's a trading system, things could get executed twice. So is the trader then responsible for paying that cost because he couldn't manage to...
But it's only computed twice. It's not executed twice.
Okay.
Think of it like quantum mechanics. If something happens, but nothing can observe that it happened, quantum mechanics allows that to happen. That's fine because no one can see it. There's no way of detecting that actually happened. And then it's the same here. From the client's perspective, they only see one execution before ever. The fact that B processed it, then it got lost, and then A had to process it, it will produce the same result. It's based on the same input and the same state.
So processing doesn't mean that something gets executed on the exchange?
No, it doesn't get executed in reality. Sorry?
At which point you actually execution the order, because you want to trade, right? You want to send this
right.
Even shares.
Yes. The point at which it's not recoverable is the point at which the client gets a message saying that something has happened.
Yeah, so
once the client has been told something, then it really has happened. But until the client has been told something, it can go through any number of attempts and failures, and then eventually the client gets told something.
So that means after server A replies, there's some additional process happening?
There is always in these systems additional processing with clearing and risk and reconciliation, other things that are going on.
So basically the client connects to A.
Yes.
How does the client get notified if A fails?
Right, okay, well in the simplest implementation, and this is what seems to be the case, is that they lose a connection when they go back to B. They have to fail over to B, they get given two IP addresses, then they have to switch across, and then they get all the events again that they missed because B is continued processing. There are more elegant strategies than that, such as setting a load balancer in front of it, hiding the fact that it switched from A to B.
You can use virtual IP addresses there.
Exactly. You can use any number of strategies to hide the fact that it's doing this at all. But the reality is I've not seen anyone go down the road because, like I said, it should fail less than once a year. So then if you've got a failover strategy you don't test regularly, is it a benefit or not? Because never really know that something you changed in the last year hasn't broken since the last time you used it in anger. So they would seem to go for the, let's just keep it really simple and we understand exactly what it's doing. Now in terms of load balancing, it looks like B is doing all the work, right? And A is kind of just sitting there watching it. What you can do is you put half the clients in A, B, and you have half the clients connect to B and then A. Right, so that you're actually running both systems all the time, but you've partitioned the clients so that they cross over. But if either one of them fails, half the clients have to switch across, and all the processing gets done in one machine.
Ah, For example, client sends request to A replicates to B, and B processes the event, and A fails. Mm-hmm. How does client get result back from B?
B has a record of all of the state changes from, say, the start of the day versus some period of time that you want to be able to relay.
But this is a request reply protocol, so
we don't want to.
But the client will get all the replies, so it's actually an asynchronous request reply. So it will suddenly start getting replies back for requests that, when it connected to B, it didn't ask for. It sent a request on A, and then B will start sending back the replies.
So you are using some queue?
Notionally, it is a queue, and we call it chronicle queue. In reality, it's actually closer to a journal, but it is a vector.
The 25 microsecond round trip is including the replication across TCP?
This is including the TCP and the replication.
And we are using what kind of hardware for the connection?
SolarFlare, okay. 10 gig.
Okay, good.
And also these were both on the same hub as far as I
know. Sorry?
They're both on the same hub, which obviously minimizes latency as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, so if A fails, the client is going to reconnect B.
Correct.
And it will then resend the event.
Yes.
And if the event has an ID, B will go, well, I've already processed this event.
Yes.
And apply the cache, the previous result.
There is a risk that the client will see duplicates, but it's better for it to see duplicates than to miss messages. So the client has a risk that in a failure situation, it needs to ignore events it's already seen. What a lot of clients do that don't handle this particularly well is they usually end up with some error and then continue to process. So they effectively ignore duplicates by just erroring out. This is often an event, like I said, it's often a scenario they don't test particularly well. But
so rather the client can see duplicates somehow tells me that it's not the client sending a request.
Yes, it has to replay from some point. Either the client has to say where it's up to, or the client has to request a certain range, or it depends on the implementation as to how they've decided that missed events will be sent to the client. And it varies depending on the implementers as to what they decided is the best strategy. But it has the capability to replay every event of that client back to the start of the day because it's an unbounded queue. And so it's more like a journal in the sense that nothing ever gets deleted as such. So it can replay anything it needs to or not, depending on the requirement of the implementers. Can we move on? Otherwise this is going to take more than that. Okay. It's cache friendly in the sense that every record is written continuously in memory. For index chronicle, the last byte of one message is immediately before the first byte of the next message. It's consumer insensitive, which is one of the properties of an unbounded queue. The producer can be any amount behind the consumer, and we've got some tests where the producer is more than main memory size behind the consumer. And in fact, you might do end of day reporting, for example. We just go through every event of the day, come up with some summary. And so the consumer wasn't even running, and the producer produced the data. How is a garbage collector? Now, this is really an interesting topic in the sense that the assumption is that you record data for an extended period of time, and then eventually you decide you want to archive it or delete it. Now, this is a big assumption because some applications are just not written that way, but that's the assumption. So the information in those logs is valuable, and you want to keep it for a certain period of time. And for example, for market data, some of the clients keep them for 5 years, which is quite a long time. Most people who use this might keep it for a day to a week, and then they might compress them. So what Vanilla Chronicle does is it makes it easier to do that by rolling the file as you use it. Whereas Index Chronicle doesn't. You actually have to flows it yourself. Okay, so let's skip the lower API and get on to collections. It's based around concurrent map, or at least how it was implemented up to Java 7, where we have many segments. Each segment is actually got a lock on it, but the segments can be accessed concurrently. It's an example where what we're doing there is we're taking an interface. This class is called Bond Video Interface. And it generates an off-heap reference to that. So you take an interface, it has getters and setters and adders and compare and swap and whatever else you want to be able to do. And it goes and implements that either on-heap or off-heap. And so you can take a reference to a piece of memory and just say, give me these fields. And the nice thing about it is that it doesn't actually, to bring it from off-heap to on-heap, it doesn't have to deserialize the whole entry. You just want to modify one field, that's all you do, you just change that field. And this is as efficient as being on the heap.
So by using this allocation of the bracket. So the second line.
Second line, acquire using. Okay, so what acquire using does is it says, give me a value for this key. The acquire means I don't care whether it existed before or not. I just want a value for this key, and if it didn't exist, go and put it in there.
So it's like putative absent or something like that.
Sorry?
Computive absent.
Yeah, computive absent, except so that the off heap reference has to exist already.
And then actually, the location driver set is publishing. So every set of action is just putting reference.
Yes, so this then becomes a reference to off-heaps, like a pointer to an off-heap place, which doesn't move, and you can then manipulate it as much as you like from then on. It actually supports locking, so entry-based locking, and entry-based volatile compare and swap operations on individual fields. So once you've got a reference to an off-heap memory, depending on how it's used, you can keep that for an extended period of time and just manipulate it from then on. The main difference is that behind the scenes, it's persisting this asynchronously by the OS, and it's shared across processes. So you can get a reference to this object on two processes, just manipulate them directly, and they see each other's changes.
But this is like JVM, two different JVM instances, or the same threads, or the two threads in a single JVM?
It's multiple JVMs, so it's cross JVM. Because it's off-heap, and you can get the same off-heap memory using shared memory in multiple processes, it's effectively embedded in every JVM that loads it. I have one client, they've got 80 JVMs on one box, and they need to share 50 gigabytes of memory. I don't know why they have lots of JVMs. And so they find this particularly useful, so that they update it once, and then it is immediately available, or as immediate as the hardware allows, immediately available to every other process in the box. So this is just some examples of accessing. This is simulating arrays within an entry by having indexed access to nested data types. Okay, so say you don't want it to actually persist to disk, you can use tempfs, obviously on Linux. On Windows, I'm not sure what is the best solution there. There are RAM drives available, but we haven't tried them. It uses a lot less memory than concurrent hash map. For very small entries, it's about a fifth size. It also has multi-master replication, but with multi-master replication, some of the rules that I mentioned before don't apply. You're not actually sharing the same memory between machines, and in reality you have to do a put. You can't just alter it, and then when you do a put, it will be replicated to another machine.
And at that point you're in split brain situations.
Yes, you run into split brain situations, and so it has a very simple reconciliation strategy, which is the last one wins, which means if your clocks are slightly out, then it might not actually be the last one, but basically it uses a timestamp and the last one wins, which means that you any changes you make need to be to the whole entry. So say you've got some sort of counter on two machines and you just count the number of page hits. It's not going to work very well. But if you have two different key values for each machine, then you'll this is running on a large machine that I've got sitting in my laundry. For the reason for picking 2.5 billion is obviously the built in collections don't support the program 2 billion very much. So the scales aren't pretty well. To give you an idea, a single thread will give you about 3 million per second for this test. So if I'm going to from 1 to 32 cores threads, you get about 12 times improvement, which is reasonable scalability. It's not really more reason. Okay, so the distribution. This is for a fixed rate of updates of 1 million per second on missing one thread. What sort of variation you get depending on the number of entries. And as you can see, the percentiles do jump up dramatically. So the typical looks very nice, as does the average. But very quickly, you start to see disturbances. This is is going through sequentially. But notionally, of course, of being a hash map, it's a random access in reality. This is running on a small machine using concurrent hash map. And as you can see with concurrent hash map, you get increasing GC times, mostly due to the overhead and in particular, the 200 megabytes is because you're getting close to the usable heap for this machine. It's a 30 gigabyte heap and it's using almost 23 gigabytes of it. So it doesn't perform particularly well.
Yes, sir?
Yes.
So how do you do with the bottom line?
Sorry, the which line?
Top. So you have to manage within your app.
Oh, this is concurrent hash map. So I'm using, I think in this case it was long key and value. So very small entry. So you're looking at the overhead here. Obviously, if you've got a very large value or even a large key, then the effect of the collection becomes less and less important. And concurrent hash map is more than fine. But if you've got a lot of small keys in particular, then the overhead of your collection starts to really matter. So that's why I look at this in more detail. So obviously, because everything's pushed off peak, you don't get any GC impact, and you also get very good stability for this range of entries. And because it's using less memory to start with, it can put more entries into it.
This is with 32 cores?
No, this is another one with 32 gigabytes of main memory.
And there's a number of CPUs?
6 cores, this one. Yeah. But it was more that these is a like-for-like test. These two are testing the same scenario. The most obvious difference is the GC times as opposed to yes, that's the other difference, is that this case I'm using a lot of heap, but in this case I actually want to have less heap, so I have more off heap, and in fact I don't need much heap at all. Part of the reason for reducing 64 meg is that some of the tests that I do are low GC, but not as low as I would like, and if you leave it on the default settings, it doesn't show up that you're actually creating a bit of garbage, so that over the test it might create 2 gigabytes, but on a 32 gig machine it will default to 8, So the fact that it produced 2 gigabytes doesn't even show off in the verbose GC logs. But if I reduce the heap down to as small as I can and still not produce a log, then I know that it didn't produce even a fraction of this, because that's just default arrangement as well, so the enum will be smaller. One thing you can take from that is that if I made it 32 megabytes, I did actually see a collection on the startup, but not once the test was run. Okay, so this is just the presentation.
To go back to the reputation, you consider to use UDP protocol instead of TCP to minimize the latency also?
Yes and no. So the objective of Q is to record everything, and so it needs to be lossless. So it only supports TCP at the moment. However, for MAC, the idea is that it keeps the latest value. So it is inherently lossy anyway, by design. So that if there's events that you missed, or values you missed per key, you just are interested in the latest value. Right? So we do have UDP replication for that. And I don't know how good the Wi-Fi is here, but when I was at DevOps, I actually showed an example of doing replication over Wi-Fi for a million updates a second.
One of the downsides with UDP though is it won't give you the bootstrapping stuff. So if you had a map which is populated on one machine and you started up a fresh machine and you wanted to replicate that across, the UDP won't give you that.
It's very difficult to get that.
Yeah, I don't get the point.
From the service perspective, it has to send everything again anyway. Because you're only talking to one. Presumably one consumer that wants to see another copy of everything. But UDP works best when you've got multiple consumers.
Yeah, okay. But on the latency perspective, maybe it's better, no?
Not particularly, no. Okay. In theory, the best case latencies for UDP tend to be better because it's a lower overhead. The problem with UDP is that the worst case latencies are...
One of them.
And if you're worried about worst case more than your best case.
Okay. One of the problems is also you kind of end up implementing TCP, IP, and then
UDP. It's just from the latency perspective I would like to have some input.
The problem if you are doing it in Java, if you are re-implementing protocol Java, you are competing against the TCP, IP stack with redundancy and the really optimized.
And routers that tend to be optimized for TCP. So what we do is we use both. So you can set a bandwidth limitation on UDP and TCP. So we have a UDP replication that's going through quite quickly and has X percentage of the bandwidth. And then we have TCP replication, which is going around slowly and uses a lower percentage of the bandwidth, and obviously with a significant fan out, it's going to take longer to go through all the keys and values, but it will go through them all reliably. So you have the TCP as a backup for UDP.
Did you run the quantum kernels?
I would. Yes, later. I would like to see it actually working for the Wi-Fi. Which demo did you?
The constant. I don't know if you.
Yes.
in that conversation. So what we don't want to do, we don't want to start spamming over on it.
I'm kind of running from scratch here.
So this process we can boost
and run it for a while. So
I think
so each one of these is doing a million requests, so it's printing out how many requests per second it's doing. And normally because I leave it like this because I don't know what sort of hardware people are running it. But usually I crank it up so it runs through faster than this.
Point to point. But if you're missing it.
So what this is doing is that I've got a gateway process and processing engine process. The gateway takes a copy of the import. It sends as much as the processing engine processing picks up this data. That's what this processing engine name is doing. And then the gateway gets the result from the processing engine and then checks the result. And it's going through at a fixed rate and it's doing a million every 5 seconds. Increase that, but let's just see what this produces. It's going to do 10 million. Usually I run this with the Bose GC on, and you'll see that it doesn't trigger any minor collections. And there seems to be some sort of problem with the latency through that. So I'll have to check that. But that's what the demo does. So there was your demo. Do you remember the name of the Cosmos?
It's in the demo.
So there's a package called Thread Affinity.
Yes.
And basically, it's a way to pin one thread to the certain CPU and just make sure nothing else runs on that CPU.
Correct.
Is there a way to do it from Java?
Well, kind of.
Only with the support of, I use JNet. So, well, actually, I have a number of strategies, but here it goes through and does apply JNet.
So pretty much the operating systems give you, besides macOS for sure, give you some nice way of actually doing it.
Yes.
They are totally different. There is a POSIX standard, I guess. Linux is the only one implementing it. Windows has some totally weird API. macOS, I haven't found anything actually working.
No, I don't know. A few people have had a look at macOS. They have that sort of binding groups, but
yeah.
It's not very, it's a bit too abstract what we want to do in terms of control.
What is your experience with running pin threads to CPU if you don't count, if you're assuming you have zero garbage collection? Does it actually kind of software compared to the
It's not about garbage collection, it's about like things like busy waiting, so you don't get context switches.
Yeah, well, I mean, garbage collection is not interfering.
No, it doesn't.
I'm using Affinity to also isolate my Drupal thread than the other administrative threads that are crashing my page. And this is totally less for this. You can put the GC threads on another CPU installing, but when the GC happens, anyway, it's moving all the reference.
Yep.
So your CPU cache is completely lost, so you have cache misses and reload. After GC, you need to reload all your reference from the main memory anyway. So you have a lot of cache misses.
That's true. The reason why you try to prevent garbage collection at all.
Yeah, because all your threads give up at that point.
Yeah.
But yes, it's just the obvious delay itself is the biggest killer. But
I guess we have to start. We got to find.
Yes. So have a look on this article on MicroJIT. I've got a program that will tell you how much MicroJIT you're getting on the machine.
It's just a basic question around latency once you upload it.
Sorry?
Are you not uploading the disk in certain setups?
Yes, it does go off to disk asynchronously. But as long as your bursts are less than 10% of your main memory size, even unchanged kernel, you might see it.
But in work on certain scenarios, it's much better than others.
Yes, but the fact is you may go from 2 gigs to get more of the gigabytes of burst activity, you can start slowing you dramatically slow down
rapidly. What scenarios were you under 3 gigabytes?